This is a Dharma talk with the title Women Ancestors in Buddhist Mythology, given at the Blue Heron Zen Community in 2023 as part of their Kyolche series of Dharma talks on women ancestors. A portion was re-recorded due to audio difficulties. Thank you for listening.
I'm glad to be here. The topic was a very narrow, limited topic, women in Buddhist mythology. It's like easy, right? So, well, it's actually vast. And we've got many women ancestors in today what we might call the Theravadin, Mahayana, Vajrayana, Pure Land, and other traditions. There's just many, many stories. So I'm staying in the Mahayana stream because that's the stream that Zen kind of flows in. And to pull myself in a little bit more, I decided just to look at two sutras. The Lotus Sutra, which is especially revered in East Asia, and then also the Vimalakirti Nirdesa Sutra. The latter work is particularly important in that it's largely about how lay practitioners can attain wisdom and liberation in the same way that monks or nuns might be able to. Talk a little bit more about that. As we go along, I'll reference Kuan Yin, Mahaprajapati, Yasodhara, Amrapali, the Naga princess, and the goddess. And that's probably enough for our pantheon. Actually, what sort of happened was during the pandemic, I said, oh, great, now I can go to Buddhist school. So I had a number of hours listening to these sutras actually on audiobook. And when I first picked up the Lotus, I don't know, 10 years ago, whatever, truth be told, I found it largely unreadable. Just couldn't do it. So I guess hearing it rather than reading it sort of was the difference that I needed. But the Vimalakirti Sutra is sort of good fun if you like metaphor and fantasy. It's got a literary flavor to it. There's some character development. There's some comedy. There's a few sparkling dialogues in it. So that one I've enjoyed reading and listening to. So anyway, little plug for the Vimalakirti Sutra. Not to assume too much prior knowledge, the Lotus of the Good Law or the True Doctrine Sutra, that's an early Mahayana text which has been revered by many Buddhists for centuries. In the Lotus, the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, has become the divine eternal Buddha who attained a perfect enlightenment endless eons ago. So his nature as the supreme object of faith and devotion is expressed partly through his language of and wondrous powers. For example, he can suddenly make visible thousands of worlds in all directions, and each world has its own Buddha. He sits on a cosmic mountaintop surrounded by a retinue of protectors and bodhisattvas. If you want a visual aid, we've got one right here in the Dharma room. We also have another one on the scroll that's hanging downstairs. This is a common motif in Buddha, you know, in Buddhist art, really from all cultures. So there you go. The Lotus is largely composed in verse. It's got 28 chapters. It's got, interestingly, a lot of charms and mantras, like our great Dharani. I'm not going to talk about the origins of it, but to say that it was first translated into Chinese, so far as we know, in the 3rd century. All throughout its history, it's been a common belief that if you chant, simple act of chanting the Lotus Sutra is going to bring you salvation. And the Nichiren and the Tendai traditions today still believe that. They still do that. 25th chapter, it's all about the great Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. And you might recall that his name is the first name in our Heart Sutra. We just chanted to a manifestation of Avalokiteshvara, Kwan Simbosal, from our Korean tradition. It's also Kuan Yin in Japan, Kuan Yin in China, Kanon in Japan. There's a whole myriad manifestations in different cultures and a whole mythology attached to Kuan Yin, Kuan Simbosal that I pass by right now. Except to say that the Vajrayana still believe that the Dalai Lama today is actually in our present time, the continuing reincarnation of Avalokiteshvara. So there you go. He comes in a minute. That's the big Bodhisattva. One of the main themes of the Lotus is that about the vocation of the Bodhisattva, because we talk about Bodhisattva vows here too. So here's just a few lines about the Bodhisattva job description from the Cleary translation of Lotus. In order to reiterate this meaning, the world-honored one spoke a verse. Bodhisattvas are always teaching joyfully and peacefully. They spread their mats out on the pure ground. They anoint their bodies with oil. They wash away their dust and grime. They wear new clean clothes. They are clean inside and out. They peacefully occupy the teacher's seat. They give explanations according to the questions they are asked. They teach monks and nuns, lay men and lay women, kings and princes, queens and princesses, courtiers and commoners, using subtle, wondrous truth and a peaceful demeanor. Okay. It's a much longer job description than that, but that just gives you a flavor of one of the expressions of the Bodhisattva vow that we can find in the Lotus Sutra. The core message of this sutra is that all beings can eventually attain enlightenment or awakening, and it's a Bodhisattva's job to help them do that. So that's at the core of our own first vow. Sentient beings are numberless. We vow to awaken as one. Second big point for the Lotus, for me, this is also an historical source of our teachings about relative truth and absolute truth. So, and there are many, many other themes in there, but that's enough of an intro to the Lotus. At the opening of the sutra, we meet women in the gathered assemblies of nuns and courtiers. At the head of this conclave of 2,000 nuns, we find Mahaprajapati, the aunt of his Siddhartha Gautama, who would later become the Shakyamuni Buddha. There's also Yasodhara. These are two pivotal women in this mythology because in the early Pali Suttas, they are the two that went to Shakyamuni and said, let women in the gate. We belong here too. And Shakyamuni said, no. And they went back and they said again, let women in. We are here. We're ready to practice. No. So they were good politicians. They decided if the Buddha wasn't going to hear it, they'd go to Ananda. And so they wore Ananda down, Ananda being the Buddha's closest confidant. So they were really pretty good at the politics there right at the beginning. And what we see in that story, that piece of mythology, is that women were there right at the very beginning speaking truth to power. In the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha will prophesy that in future ages, both Mahaprajapati and Yasodhara will attain Buddhahood and be seen by all as Bodhisattva living beings, thus come one, and a Buddha endowed with 10,000 glowing marks, thus come one. So that's a long title. And all of these Bodhisattvas, the myriad Bodhisattvas, all have titles like this that point to a particular sort of facet of the Dharma and their Dharma mojo, if you will. Okay. Now, monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, that's mentioned myriad times. The Buddha, in several sections, also admonishes Manjushri, wisdom, Bodhisattva repeatedly that men, women, boys, and girls are to be taught the Dharma without distinction. So we get a kind of egalitarian spin in some parts of the Lotus that all genders will eventually awaken, but this isn't consistent. So other parts of it relate a kind of monkish, even prudish discomfort that can veer at times into misogyny. For example, we see passages of the Lotus where the Buddha lands are described as free of women, as childbirth will no longer be needed. So women being the source biologically of our human rebirth, this is what in the early Buddhism we're trying to get away from. We don't want to keep being born. So there's a little bit of that there. But at a basic level, male monks, this is the teaching, you all know it. The female body is a symbol of attachment to worldly desire and sensuality. Don't do that. And we've got bunches of stories. So we can think of the dancing girls, right, in the court of Siddhartha, who maybe he was kind of, well, I could just stay here and let them entertain me instead of going out on my quest. Or he's under the Bodhi tree and the daughters of Mara appear. Not the sons of Mara, but the daughters of Mara appear. You sure you want this awakening thing? I don't know. No, we're more interesting. So this theme, you know, and we see this trope in all kinds of traditions. It's not just Buddhism. So we build up a whole monastic code of conduct called the Vinaya. Part of that is about keep the sexes apart. The women are also, in the vocations of nuns, are subject to the Vinaya. But there's some additional admonitions and restrictions there as well. So this kind of tension in the tradition, the monastic sort of wariness of fraternization of the genders, and then what happens in real life in the lay world, you know, that tension is there. In terms of the Lotus Sutra, we might use the term polyvocal to describe these mixed messages that you can detect. So Mahayana, just like every world religion, has an idealistic view of salvation that can get bogged down in cultural taboos around sex, reproduction, desire, okay? So we just note those so that kind of dissonance isn't glossed over. All right, but to the first story, that of the Naga princess. So the clearest way I might describe her is as a mermaid, half fish, half human. She's got both animal and human karma. In the Clary translation, she's simply called an ocean spirit. In other versions, she is the daughter of a dragon king. Who's seen the Aquaman movie? That's that mythology right there in that movie. So the other character in this dialogue is Shariputra, who we know is one of the Buddha's closest disciples. We reference him in the Heart Sutra as well. In both of these sutras, he's something of a comic figure. He serves as an avatar for sort of the lesser vehicle. So that's the cast. And one more. Here we go. Manjushri, Bodhisattva wisdom, has recently returned from the ocean kingdom, doing the work of spreading the Lotus Sutra to the Nagas. Here's some of the dialogue. Manjushri. The ocean spirit king, Sagara, has a daughter who is just 8 years old. She is wise and intelligent, and she has a good knowledge of all the basic behaviors of living beings. She has attained the power of holding her mind on true reality, and she has been able to accept and uphold the most profound secret treasury taught by the Buddhas. She has entered deeply into meditative contemplation. She comprehends all the teachings. What her mind thinks about, what her mouth expresses, is subtle, wonderful, far-reaching, great. She is capable of arriving at enlightenment. Before Manjushri finishes this speech, the ocean spirit king's daughter suddenly appears before him, bows, stands to one side, and says, "I have heard your teachings and achieved enlightenment, as only the Buddhas can attest to. I present the teaching of the great journey to liberate living beings from suffering." Bodhisattva vow. Okay, the old school. Shariputra then asks the ocean girl, "You say you have attained the supreme path so quickly, but how can this be? A female body is defiled and cannot be a vessel of true teaching. So how can you manage to achieve supreme enlightenment? The path is long and can only be consummated after countless eons and lives of diligent effort and practice. How could you, with your female body, have so quickly become enlightened?" At that point, the ocean spirit girl takes a precious pearl, equal in value to all of the worlds of all of the galaxies, and offers it to the Buddha. The Buddha immediately accepts it from her. Then the ocean spirit girl says to Bodhisattva accumulated wisdom, and to Manjushri, and to Shariputra, "I offered the precious pearl, and the Buddha accepted it. Did it not happen quickly?" They answered, "Very quickly." She said, "Then use your spiritual powers and watch how I attain enlightenment, and you will see it's quicker than this." So the whole assembly sees her in an instant complete the practices of the Bodhisattva, journey to the undefiled world of the South, sit on a jewel lotus, and achieved true enlightenment. She acquires the 32 marks of the enlightened ones and the 80 virtues and begins setting forth the wondrous teachings for all living beings of all the worlds in the 10 directions. Okay. Version one. I won't tell you the whole version story again. Some of you might have heard Zhangji Sensa's opening talk referencing this slippery slope of translation. So if you're going to the sutras intentionally looking for answers to a question, you maybe want to look at more than one translation. Here's the Burton Watson's translation, a little bit earlier, a little bit more forwardly styled. This is just three passages. The dragon girl had a precious jewel worth as much as the million-fold world, and she presented it to the Buddha. The Buddha accepted it. The dragon girl said to Bodhisattva, "Wisdom accumulated, and to Shariputra, I presented the precious jewel. The world-honored one accepted it. Was that not quickly done?" They replied, "Yes, very quickly." The girl said, "Then employ your supernatural powers and watch me attain Buddhahood." At that time, all of the members of the assembly saw the dragon girl in the space of an instant change into a man and then carry out all the practices of the Bodhisattvas, immediately proceeding to the spotless world of the South, taking her seat on the jewel, his seat on the jewel lotus, and attaining impartial and correct enlightenment. Okay, so what's going on there? What's this changing into a man line about, right? So we've got either Cleary's modern translation. Did he just kind of resolve that tension by just leaving that out? Is Watson's translation based on a text, the earlier version of that had been loaded up with some cultural expectations and norms? I don't know. You know, just as with the Bible, if you read different translations, you can get pointed in different directions. One of the fun things for me about studying these myths is that we can arrive at our own interpretations. For me, it doesn't really matter if she changed herself into a man or not in that split second of transformation. If she did, I like to just think that she was kind of thumbing her nose at Shariputra. See what I can do? Demonstrating the relativity of gender concepts. But you could do a more literal reading of the Watson translation and come to a different conclusion, that there's some misogyny again here at the heart of the teaching. That's the lotus, okay? But we've got Mahaprajapati, we've got Yasadora, we have the Naga princess, and they're all in different ways questioning this idea about gender and gender separation. Now, we get to the Vimalakirti Sutra. So this has, a bit more internal narrative. It's got a little more philosophical consistency than the lotus, but it's just as fantastic. So the main character here is Vimalakirti, the lay practitioner. He's been practicing a long time. He has a cosmic reputation as being perhaps the second only to the Buddha himself in terms of his enlightenment. And he lives in a room, a single small room, like just a monk's room. Very, very simple. Yet he can entertain all of these Buddhas and courts and assemblies from all of the thousands of worlds in his room. So there's a big leap you have to make from form as we see it, space as we see it, to this idea of vast galaxies fitting into a little room. If you're a science fiction fan, you know who does that, right? Doctor Who and his TARDIS. But anyway, the point here is that Vimalakirti is also explaining the Bodhisattva's job description, but how the lay Bodhisattva lives in the world, how we can engage the world fully, how we can partake of its pleasures, its passions, its defilements, its disappointments, its joys, how we can partake of all of that without becoming attached to or constrained by them. So this is kind of different than what we're talking about in early Buddhism, right? The sutra here opens in the garden of Amrapali. So she's a courtesan from Vaishali. She became a patron of the historical Buddha. In fact, she donated the mango grove called Amrapalivana to the Buddha and the Sangha. Amrapalivana became the site of several teachings on the foundations of mindfulness, or the Satipatthana. She eventually becomes a nun and attains the realization of arhathood, you know, the kind of nirvana state. So it's a woman, another woman ancestor that literally presents the Buddha with a garden in which to present his core teachings upon mindfulness. And then she follows through on that. She not only donates the garden, but she embarks on the path. In the famous passage, though, in the Vimalakirti Sutra, Manjushri again and Vimalakirti are having a conversation about the characteristics of a bodhisattva. It's amusing to say that Manjushri is only visiting Vimalakirti because the Buddha told him to. None of the other bodhisattvas were going to set foot in that room because they knew in a Dharma discussion or debate they would be taken down. Manjushri says, all right, I can do it. Goes. So there's a lot of talking in this sutra. But the point here is that it's the same kind of story. Manjushri, Shariputra, or a woman will appear. I'm not going to do the whole dialogue with you in the interest of time. Let's just say they have a very edifying discussion and we get some kind of wisdom from it. And then they wrap that up, and then at that point, the goddess appears. So thereupon, a goddess who had lived in that grove, having heard their teaching of the Dharma of the great heroic bodhisattvas, she was delighted, pleased, and overjoyed. She manifested herself in a material body and showered the bodhisattvas and the disciples with heavenly flowers. When the flowers fell on the bodies of the bodhisattvas, they fell off on the ground. But when they fell on the body of the great disciples, they stuck to them and did not fall. The great disciple shook the flowers and even tried to use their magical powers, but still the flowers would not shake off. Shariputra reproached the goddess, saying, "Goddess, these flowers are not proper for religious persons, and so we must shake them off." The goddess says, "Do not say that, Shariputra. Why? These flowers are proper indeed. Why? Such flowers have neither constructual thought nor discrimination." But the elder Shariputra has both constructual thought and discrimination. So he and the disciples cannot shake off the flowers. Then they get into it. There's a long dialogue, and it doesn't take long for him to be stumped by several of her questions. So let's fast forward to where he finally is grudgingly accepting that he has been bested in this discussion with the goddess. "Excellent, excellent goddess, pray, what have you attained? What have you realized that you have such eloquence?" The goddess, "I have attained nothing, Reverend Shariputra. I have no revelation. Therefore, I have eloquence. Whoever thinks I have attained, I have realized, is overly proud in the discipline of the well-taught Dharma." Burn. Well, he's got one more card up his sleeve.
He asks, "Goddess, what prevents you from transforming yourself out of your female state?" And the goddess replies, "Although I have sought my female state for many years, I have not yet found it. Shariputra, if a magician were to incarnate a woman by magic, would you ask her, 'What prevents you from transforming yourself out of your female state?'" Shariputra, "No, such a woman would not really exist. So what would there be to transform?" Goddess, "Just so, Reverend Shariputra. All things do not really exist. Now, would you think, 'What prevents one whose nature is that of a magical incarnation from transforming herself out of her female state?'" Thereupon, the goddess employed her magical power to cause the elder Shariputra to appear in her form and to cause herself
to appear in his form. Then the goddess, transformed into Shariputra, said to Shariputra, now transformed into a goddess, Reverend Shariputra, what prevents you from transforming yourself out of your female state? And Shariputra, transformed into the goddess, replied, I no longer appear in the form of a male. My body has changed into the body of a woman. I do not know what to transform. The goddess continued, If the elder could again change out of the female state, then all women could also change out of their female states. All women appear in the form of women in just the same way as the elder appears in the form of a woman. While they are not women in reality, they appear in the form of women. With this in mind, the Buddha said, In all things there is neither male nor female. Then the goddess released her magical power, and each returned to their ordinary forms.
She then said to him, Reverend Shariputra, what have you done with your female form? Shariputra, I neither made it nor did I change it. Just so, all things are neither made nor changed, and they are not made and not changed. That is the teaching of the Buddha. All things are neither made nor changed. They are not made and not changed. That's the teaching of the Buddha. All right, so what can we take away from this little encounter? Well, the goddess is asking Shariputra, what are you attached to? Who are you looking down on? I hear Zhangji Sunsa saying the similar thing a week ago. Who do you think you are? So the goddess is using humor and a sort of magical performance art to make this point. But we all, if we're honest, I think we all are challenged by these kinds of questions. Certainly in our relationships with, as my parents used to say, the opposite sex, but even people of our own gender, and even transgender folks and non-binary folks. What am I attached to? Who do I think I am? What am I looking down on? So here, the sutra is sort of telling us that you can transcend these conventional categories of gender. I like this point, though. I think I want to bring this out. The goddess returns to her female form. She doesn't erase the particular unique nature of her form or the body. So to me, this feels like a teaching that may be encouraging us to embrace our own bodies in all their specifics, and that might be gender, sex, culture, race, age, health, illness, all of those things that are specific or unique to each of us. Contemporary teacher Zhenyu Earthlin Manuel, she also sums it up this way. We need this particular body with its unique color, shape, and sex for liberation to unfold. There is no experience of emptiness, no experience of liberation without interrelationship with form. And we find that teaching in the Heart Sutra as well, right? Form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Okay. If gender is as flexible as maybe is indicated in these stories, and certainly if gender is as flexible or amorphous as we are talking about in our culture today, then we might be able to awaken and achieve enlightenment from any and all gender categories. Or when we're talking with one another, we might actually transcend those categories, and then we have a different kind of discussion. I might say there are several other sutras that take up this theme of transformation. They repurpose the story in either the Lotus or in the Vimalakirti. There's a whole number of versions of these, but in relatively more obscure sutras. So I don't know what to say, except when I looked at this, I'm kind of aware that my own conditioning around karma, my own conditioning and karma around gender and men and women and transgender people and non-binary people, that's really strong. That conditioning is pretty strong. So we just take one step at a time and we try to open up our eyes and open up our ears, just open up everything a bit wider. Finishing up. In all of these mythological stories, the myths are reflecting time, place, and culture. The stories can influence the culture that they appear in, but in the process, they're also shaped by that culture. So there's a very dynamic kind of ongoing conversation, if you will, between mythology and the life as we're living it in the moment. Our myths are not going to be internally logical or consistent. Wisdom can be very messy, inconsistent, paradoxical. So I read these stories as just kind of metaphors and folk tales, and there's some superstition. Here we are in a scientific age, and this is, you know, just from something in the distant past. That's my relationship to them. To this day, in East Asia, there are people who are reading these as sacred truth and building huge statues to these bodhisattvas and praying to them and telling these stories. I mentioned to Zhongji Sansa, I couldn't find it. The Peking Opera in China has five main stories that they tell over and over and over again in the traditional operas that they present. One of them is the Naga Princess story with the jewel. So that myth is deeply, deeply part of Chinese culture. That is still alive today, that story. So I would just say for us, looking at mythology, it's part of our Buddhist legacy. You know, it can enliven our imaginations if we don't get mired in doctrinal details about whether this could be true or this is not true. Let's not spend time talking about how many bodhisattvas can dance on the head of a pin, though there are some philosophy classes where you could go do that. Go do it there, and it's wonderful. But don't let it present an obstacle to the simplicity of being, from my point of view, right here together in the room today. So we can simply say, maybe, what a story. And maybe we hear something that we're entertained by, or on some kind of deeper level, we feel something. We get something that, as the goddess says, is deeper than our constructions and discriminations of our mind. John, where am I at time? How did I do?
10:27.
Okay, I've got time for the last little teaser. But this is actually my favorite part. The Jataka tales, do we know the Jataka tales? These are a whole set of stories about the life of the Buddha in succeeding incarnations before he became the Buddha. I'll finish with this one. This is courtesy of the Tibetan Buddhist scholar Enyogini Pema Khandro. In the third lifetime, the Buddha was born a princess who was also the sister of the Buddha of previous eons, Buddha Forma Dipankara. During that life, the princess made an offering of white mustard oil to an old monk. She gave this to the monk so that the oil could be used to light butter lamps as an offering to the Buddha of that time. When she made this offering, she also declared an aspiration. She wished that in a future life, for the sake of all sentient beings, she would become a Buddha. When the monk told the Buddha of previous eons of the princess's aspiration, he responded with a prediction. He foretold that in the future, she would be told. He predicted that she would be told, and it would be predicted that she would become the Buddha of the next eon, our present age, the Buddha Gautama, Siddhartha Gautama. And there we are. That just fascinates me. That's a whole other talk right there. All right, let's wrap that up. Thank you. A question. I think we have time for questions and some reflections or commentary. Thank you for listening to me talk.